This is tape number 3 of the Diaconate Studies in Biblical Criticism and Old Testament for the Home Temple. Now, I told you that in the Northern Kingdom, which flourished from about 900 BC to about 700 BC, and in the Southern Kingdom, which flourished from about 900 BC to about 500 BC, these are very general dates, before both of them fell to invasion. First case, the Northern Kingdom, Israel to the Assyrians, and in the second case, the one that outlived it for a couple of centuries, but was finally taken over by the captivity of the Babylonians. In both cases, they referred to, apparently they had a different way of referring to the deity. And in the Northern tradition, the Southern tradition, the deity was referred to as Elohim or as Tetragrammaton, YHWH, Yahweh, or however it might have been. And so we are able to see how the priests and scribes at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, who were part of the returning group from Babylon, who had permission from the Babylonian ruler to come and reestablish not a country, not a nation, not a political thing, but a temple and a Jewish religious practice that the Babylonians had learned to respect through the collegial interaction with the two priesthoods for some time, several generations during the captivity. And of course, these people, first they built the temple, and then they did what they were not supposed to do. They built up the walls and reinforced them. Pretty soon, the Jews were starting themselves a country again, and before you knew it, there was another Israel. An Israel which lasted down until the time of Augustus Caesar. And at that time, an Israel that had become so corrupt politically that people actually went to the Emperor of Rome and asked him to come and take it over. And which he happily did, and by the time of Jesus, Palestine and that area was part of a tetrarchy. It was ruled very cruelly by the Romans, and the people who, the sort of a Jewish establishment who had felt that this would have been the right thing to happen, were flourishing, but everybody else was not. So we have, in the history of Israel, we have the establishment of the first nation of Israel under David, the kingdom of David and of Solomon, that splits into two kingdoms. So from about 1000 BC to about 900 BC, we have the kingdom of David and Solomon. Then from about 900 to 700, we have Israel. And 900 to 500 or so, we have Judah. Both of them disappear, and then in the 500s and 400s, the exiles come back, start rebuilding the temple. All this activity comes. The Jews become a people of the book. And by 300, 200, the Maccabean revolt and other kinds of things, the new Israel is established, and it reaches the size. It attains the size almost of the empire of Solomon. This is the period of the Second Temple. But it surrenders itself and gives itself over to the Roman Empire about 40 years B.C. For political reasons and other kinds of reasons. And by the time of Jesus, it's a captive land. It's being ruled by the Romans. And it's rebelling against that rule. Now, in the context of the return from exile then, as all this traditional literature, chronicles, proverbs, psalms, things that were used for liturgies in the temple, prophetic writings, all kinds of things were conflated and put together and brought together as literature to be remembered now and be written down and be spoken and taught to people, etc. As this was happening, we got some very strange productions. If you look carefully at the book of Genesis, look at the story of Noah and the ark, you'll find there is not just one story there. There are two stories. One story tells about Noah getting two of every kind of animal and putting those onto the ark. The other story tells about Noah getting seven of every kind of animal and putting them onto the ark. And guess what? One of the stories refers to God always and consistently as Elohim, and the other one refers to God always and consistently as Yahweh. And as we go through the Pentateuch, and as we go through the different sections of it, we find all kinds of repeats of this situation where the same story is told twice, but by different storytellers, one of whom was what we call the Yahwist, and we just abbreviate him as J, and one of whom is told by the Elohist. So what the priests did is they didn't lose anything. They didn't throw away anything. They just conflated it all together. And very simply, in a simple way, we can identify four sources of all the parts that are patched together to make Genesis and Exodus and all these. We can refer to the J source, that's the Yahwist. That's one whole cycle of transmission of tradition. Then we can refer to the E. We have J, now we have E, that's the Elohist. And then we have P, that's the priestly source. That's the one who codifies all the laws and rules about clean and unclean, Leviticus, all this sort of thing. And then we have D, the Deuteronomist, the person who does this all from the standpoint of what will eventually become the synagogue, because there is no temple at this time. And so people begin establishing, as the temple is being rebuilt, they build their own little local temples, which are we call synagogues, gathering places. And then after the temple is built, those synagogues still stay there. And people make a journey and a pilgrimage to the temple at Jerusalem on special days like Passover or something like that. But they do most of their religious work in their own synagogues. And guess what? The synagogues don't do animal sacrifice. The temple is a place where animals are regularly sacrificed and bled, and birds and animals are sacrificed, and rituals are gone through in the style of the old ancient Near East. But the synagogues are places where there are no sacrifices, and a whole philosophy develops out of this that's anti-synagogue, anti-temple. This anti-temple establishment. And out of that grow the Essenes and all the other groups of heterodox Jews that do not feel that the temple is the right place or that the priesthood is even legitimate. There is a whole business about whether they should be in a solar calendar or a lunar calendar and whether the priesthood is correct, etc. And that's where these communities, the Essene communities and the Zadokites and all these other people, live apart from the temple and do not even acknowledge the priesthood of the temple. And they believe that sacrifice should be the sacrifice of a pure heart and the sacrifice of righteousness and the sacrifice of thanksgiving. And many of these people become vegetarians and they believe that animal sacrifice is wrong. And they come up with a different kind of sacred sacrifice. These are meals of bread and wine, things that are very much like the Christian Eucharist becomes. And like Jesus, they don't like the people sacrificing animals in the temple and all those sort of thing. It's a whole different tradition. It's an anti-tradition. It grows out of the prophetic tradition, but the prophetic tradition versus the monarchic tradition now becomes the temple establishment priesthood versus the heterodox Jews and the Essenes and all the other kinds of sects that there are out there. And out of this great ferment of religious activity among Jews comes all the components that lead to the Messianic movements that eventually creates Messianic Judaism, that creates what we now call Christianity. So now we have a Bible, and the Torah itself is made of the conflation together of things from at least four different sources, J, E, P, and D, as we describe them. And then the issue comes about what are the weightiest things, what is the Bible used for? Well, in one tradition, the tradition that will develop as a tradition of rabbinic Judaism, the Pentateuch becomes the Torah. It becomes the basis for law and interpreting God's will, etc. And it is done just like lawyers do with the Constitution, except it's interpreted allegorically, it's interpreted in different ways, they're not really called rabbis yet, but proto-rabbis or lawyers or Hasidim discuss and dispute what God's will is based on what it was in the past in another situation for a similar like type of situation, because new things are always developing. So the whole process of exegesis and interpretation develops, and that is what Jesus called the tradition of men as opposed to the tradition of God. Because many of these interpretations and many of these exegeses were self-serving. They were to let the rich off of their responsibilities and let men divorce their wives without taking any responsibility for them afterwards and all kinds of things. These were the things that were hated by Jesus and the prophets and so on. So this form of exegesis developed. That was one thing that the scriptures or the Bible was used for. But another thing they were used for were teaching moral virtue. Because in the synagogues, and every young Jewish boy had to learn to read. And they read in the synagogue just as Jewish people do today when they're bar mitzvahed and so on. Boys do. And girls today with bat mitzvahs. And the prophets were the great moral teachers, the social reformers. Their issues were the issues that still exist today of social justice. They believed in an egalitarian society, no kings, no rulers, no rich class, no poor class. They believed in the responsibility, the moral responsibility of each individual, and they were very strongly inspired. They were like the Hebrew prophets were very much like the Greek philosophers, they were very respected. They were channels. The word prophet, Navi, means a bubbling spring, a bubbling, overflowing thing filled with inspiration. And this is what the prophets were. The prophets were very, they were magical. They meditated. They had power over weather. They could raise the dead. They could do these other kinds of things. They were the powerful and magical mystics of ancient Israel. And from their tradition, all the writings were kept. And people studied those. And then, of course, the Psalms and things like that were used in the liturgy. And they were also used by small Jewish groups of devout Jews who were not temple-going, but who were synagogue-going or heterodox. And they developed their own Chabura meals and groups around table where they would recite psalms and read scripture from the prophets and so on. And so there were many different uses. All these scriptures were read in the synagogues. They were used. They were the reading lessons that people grew up with. And they were used for moral lessons. And many of the things that were said in the prophets and the spirit of what was said in the prophets really contradicted the priestly rules and the priestly laws. For example, you find in the teachings of Jesus a situation where Jesus and his disciples are going through a field on the Sabbath day and gleaning it. That is, it was the right of wandering holy people to glean the leftovers, what was left after a field had been harvested. He was doing this on the Sabbath day. And when he was dressed down for this by some lawyers and some priestly people who were interpreters of the priestly parts of the Torah, etc., that said you shouldn't work on the Sabbath, and this is how we've interpreted it, etc., Sabbath laws. Jesus said, well, have you never heard of David when he was hungry and needed food, that he actually went into the temple, or he went into the temple in the Holy of Holies and took the showbread and ate it and shared it with his men and so on. So this very different, very different approaches, that I call a prophetic approach and the rabbinic approach. to law and God's will and what's right and what's wrong. The prophetic approach had a much more intimate relationship with God. The rabbinic approach had a much more legalistic relationship. These are the rules, thou shalt not. This is what Paul, who was trained as a rabbi by Gamaliel, was the only early advocate of early Christianity who was rabbinically trained. This is what he was talking about when he talked about the age of the law has passed, the age of the Torah, which was our pedagogue, and we now are going into the age of the Spirit, which is the era in which our hearts rule, not our minds. Now, the interpretation of Scripture, not only what was Scripture, because that was disputed. Some people said, well, only the Torah is true Scripture, the prophets and things are lesser importance. Other people said, no, the whole thing is important. We had a big difference between two major schools. These represented really two different social groups and economic groups as well. We know them in the New Testament later on as the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sadducees accepted only the first five books, the Torah. And the Sadducees were liberals. They were so Hellenized that they actually went through surgery to have their foreskin surgically repaired and put back on again so that people would not know in the gymnasiums that they were Jewish. And many of them were very wealthy, and they were the people that had handed over Israel to the Roman Empire. And the Sadducees did not believe in life after death or resurrection, and they were very conservative theologically. Now, the much larger group and the much more popular party was that of the Pharisees, and it was out of Pharisaic Judaism that modern rabbinic Judaism came, and the Sadducee party essentially ended or stopped existing after the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70 and 72 and so on. We don't hear of them anymore after that. But it's out of the Pharisaic party that really what becomes modern Judaism emerges. And the Pharisees believed in the resurrection after death and in saints, and they accepted all the literature, and especially with respect to the literature of the prophets, etc. And they tended to be anti-temple establishment. The temple establishment very often was Sadduceic in certain cases. And the Pharisees were also developing legal traditions based on not only the Torah, but also writings of the prophets, etc. And we had within this school, we had other schools. We had liberal and conservative schools, the school of Hillel. Hillel was famous for his saying, thou shalt do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. And Jesus turned that around. It was a very well-known saying in his day, and said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And Shammai, whose name means heaven, was the proponent of another school that was more conservative and had a little harsher view of how people should be religious and so on. So we have just these sects. We can go much farther into the history of the sects, though. If we start with the 6th century B.C. in Palestinian Judaism with prophets and Nazarites and some other people, and in the diaspora with those who are in the captivity, the Babylonian captivity, influenced by Persian religious cosmology and cosmogony and mythology and the priestly code and the cult and so on. And then we have, actually, in Palestine, the Samaritan and Galilean forms of Judaism. These are the people that weren't wealthy enough or royal enough to be snatched and taken whole over to Babylon in order to stamp out the royal line in this period. There's the people of the land that just survived. These were the people out of which Jesus emerged. He was a Galilean. And Galilean religion was very much different than Palestinian religion. Palestinian religion, which included the city of Jerusalem and the temple establishment and the Pharisees associated there as well as the Sadducees, was much more legalistic. But in Galilee, rabbis were mystics. They went into trances. They did healing at a distance. They did scrying. They did mystic ascent, etc. And Jesus came out of that tradition of Samaritan and Galilean Judaism. And out of the Palestinian Judaism came the Sopherim, the wise men and the scribes, the people who began to interpret Scripture that way. And out of the diaspora, the Jews outside of Palestine in Babylon and other places, came a whole activity of the Hellenization or the Greekization on speculative thought of combining Jewish and Greek ideas, the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament being written, etc., and Egyptian religion and wisdom religion and so on. And by the 3rd century B.C., we have the Hasidim, who are really the prototypes of the Pharisees, and the Sadducees emerging as in different paths of activities. And then we have the Nazarites and the Zadokites. The Zadokites are those who accept the priesthood of Zadok, not the priesthood that has been restored through the priestly, through the kingly lineage of the Second Temple political Jewish establishment. And so they have an issue about priesthood, and they become one of the first separated communities. And out of these areas come the Damascus community, the two different kinds of Essene communities, the Qumran community, the Nazarenes. And then in Egypt, the Therapeutai, who are a mystic sect of healers that are somewhat related to the Essenes. And they become, now we have the production by the 2nd century of what we call the baptizing sects. Sects who bring people into their ranks by baptism. Baptism being a symbol of the passing through water, of a passing through the Jordan into the Holy Land, into the Promised Land, and also a symbol of birth and many other things. It's a very ancient symbol. And the baptizing sects use baptism to initiate people into their groups. They use sacred lustrations or washings, hand washings at certain times. They eat a sacred meal of bread and wine and fish. They use sacramentalism outside of the temple, no animal sacrifice. They're very opposed to temple sacramentary things and temple priesthood, and especially to animal sacrifice. And these include not only the Qumran community, and the Essenes, or as they are called, the Therapeutai, but the Gorathians, or the Genistai, the Sabaeans, the Masbothians, the Hemero-Baptists, later on the Dosithians. And then there is a third party called the Zealots. These are really the political and religious party of Galilean origin, and they will have no king at all. They are basically theocratic. God should be king, all men should be brothers, the brotherhood of man, etc. And the Zealots are the ones that take it upon themselves to start assassinating the Romans. They become what are called sicarii. These are the assassins who crowd up in a crowd of Romans in togas, and they're dressed like them, and they have under their toga a knife, and they stick it in someone's back and melt into the crowd, and the Roman official lies bleeding on the ground, etc. And this is the kind of political activity that things had come to at the time of Jesus, where there were messianic, apocalyptic groups that wanted to force Rome's hand, wanted to kick Rome out, wanted to force the coming of the Messiah to drive out the Romans, and do so by violent means. And there were, in fact, several people who were considered to be the Messiah, who were crucified by the Romans, and who were, and they become such troublemakers for those people that were in authority and that were doing well with the establishment in Jerusalem, not just Sadducees, but also Pharisees, that even Jews had turned against them as extremists and would turn them in, and there was all kinds of treachery and backstabbing and political turmoil going on within Judaism as well as against the Roman occupiers. So the Zealots were the real rabble rousers and troublemakers, and it's interesting to note that of all the 12 apostles there's actually about 18 apostles that are spoken of in the different New Testament Gospels, nearly all of them have zealot names, like Simon. And many of the other names were names that were actually typical of zealots in Galilee. And the idea that some people had, like Judas, who was also a zealot name, common name in Galilee, that Jesus would lead some kind of a political revolt, and that possibly he had to be pushed into doing that, into assuming his charismatic role as popular leader in order to make this happen. This may have been the motivation behind Judas' betrayal of Jesus, not just weak character or someone who wanted to make some money, but rather someone who felt that by pushing him politically, he would get Jesus to act the way he thought Jesus was supposed to act. But anyway, this whole business of violent, zealot Christs and Messiahs was something that was going on quite a bit before Jesus entered the scene, before he entered the scene with his preaching. And that's why he was misidentified as that sort of a danger to the society, and why the Jewish establishment itself wanted to get rid of him, because he was so popular and they were afraid that he could turn into a leader of a popular uprising and cause much, much more instability and so on. So that's the context that happens in Jewish sectarianism. That's how the scripture is used. That's how what the Bible was for, or so to speak. It had many, many different uses, whether it was priestly or prophetic or in the sects. And the Bible was still being produced. Inspired books were being written all the time in 3rd century, 2nd century, 1st century, A.D. 1st century, A.D. 2nd century. And these books are here in your other Bible, and as you read through some of them, which I will discuss on the other half of this tape, you will be able to place and understand where they're coming from and why they're written. The most important thing for you to gain from this introduction to the Old Testament of the Bible is an understanding that the Bible is literature. It's written by human beings. It's not an infallible anything. It comes in, every sentence in the Bible comes in at least 2 or 3 versions. We don't really know where a lot of it came from, and it's not written in stone by God. It's written by human beings, and it's interpreted by human beings. And it's not the final and ultimate authority on anything. And it covers a span of 1,000 years, and it has a lot of contradictions in it because it refers to lots of different stages and developments of humanity. And you can see their stages, and you can see their developments as they move. And the great thing the Bible teaches us is how humanity progresses in its spiritual growth and understanding. And it points a direction for us. If people could be doing that 3,000 years ago, we can be doing that today. And we are doing that. We have to recognize that we are doing that. So the Bible is an unfolding drama of the human return to the divine, and human ideas about the divine, and human ideas about the divine human. And it can be studied from many standpoints: the development of the prophetic ideal of the Messiah, the development of the responsibility of the individual for his own soul, many other kinds of things. But the Bible is a process, and it is not a textbook, not a textbook of science or of geography or of anything else. It is something that we have to study intelligently in order to understand the great spiritual lessons it really has to teach us. You cannot intelligently read a Bible like you read a police report, or like you read a story, or like you read a newspaper, or like you read a book of laws for life. People say, go back to the Bible and follow the Bible and let the Bible guide your life. That's not something you can really do. Certain parts of the Bible can become important to you. Certain parts of it can be guideposts for you. But the processes that the Jews and the Hebrews go through, and the processes that lead through the Bible and develop spirituality in human beings, are perhaps the most instructive things that we find in the Bible. And in order to understand these things, we have to study the Bible as literature and as history and as a chronicle of a changing spirituality of humanity as it grows from a younger to a more mature state. On the other side of this tape, we'll discuss some of the selections from the other Bible.